We were very much hoping to introduce you today to Joanna Trollope. Unfortunately, she phoned us early this morning. She's very poorly and can't physically get here. She's devastated, so we're, of course, looking forward to seeing her. However, in her stead, we have, by the magic of previous experience of Footlights, and being an all-round good egg, the wonderful Penny Hubbard is going to put on her Joanna Trollope hat. And she is armed with Joanna's script. So, with a lot of briefing and cross fingers, can I introduce Penny Hubbard, a.k.a. Joanna Trollope?
I was at Newnham in 1979, and when I came back to Cambridge 20 years ago with my husband, we moved from Fulham into a lovely old farmhouse that we were renting in Trumpington, where our garden ended with a beautiful wall, and behind the wall was the village church, and I rather felt as if I was living in a Joanna Trollope novel. Little did I realise that 20 years later I was actually going to have to be her. I've read through the speech once, it's great, so forgive me if I do stumble, but I'm going to do my absolute best. Speaking to Joanna's PA this morning, when I told her this story about me feeling as if I was living in a Joanna Trollope novel, she said, well, actually, Joanna has now changed her focus a bit. Having moved back to the city, she's moved on from the countryside novels into looking at modern society, women who are out there in society, so military wives. Balancing Acts is about a woman who, women who founded a pottery. And her latest one is sort of hot off the press hearing today, which is going to be published in 2017. Its working title is The Money Girls, and it's all about women in the city, women who are big in the world of banking and in consultancy. And again, she's looking at the dynamics between them and their family and the role that husbands play with that. So we look forward to that when it's published. So fathers and fatherhood for the 21st century. It's very flattering indeed to have been asked to speak to you today. But I have to emphasise from the outset that I am no expert. I'm rather a novelist who likes to get conversations going about contemporary ways of behaving and codes of conduct by describing what I see from many, many points of view, rather than ever trying to do more than urge readers towards some kind of decision or conviction which may or very well may not be mine. I'm a noticer, an observer. I have no evangelising or didactic purpose, so everything I'm about to say and read has to be seen in that light. I see people behaving in certain ways. I see that how people behave impacts strongly on those around them. But even if I draw conclusions from what I see, those conclusions are my affair and not necessarily those of my readers. I want to lay out the carpet of human conduct and invite readers to walk on it. It's for them to make their minds up for themselves, and it's astonishing how they persist in seeing only what they want to see. Just, I expect, as I do and you do. That is the human condition. So what I'd like to do this morning is to tell you something of my own experience and thoughts and read you some passages from my two most recent novels which are relevant to today's most interesting topic, and generally try and set some hairs running. In short, to do what I try to do as a novelist, to start the conversation. The first thing I'd like to say is how times have changed, even since I've known them. In two generations, we've gone from a model of fatherhood, which, although there were significant exceptions, society forbade from being at all intimate with their children. It was considered neither manly nor appropriate for a father to cook, change nappies, supervise bath time, or be a natural first port of call if you fell out of a tree. Fast forward two generations, and society is now urging fathers to be as intimately present in their children's lives as their mothers traditionally were. The National Literacy Trust, of which I'm a trustee, probably expends more effort in trying to involve fathers in education and play than it does mothers. A role model like David Beckham, proud and doting father of four, is a prime example of society's complete volte-face about what constitutes manliness, which these days definitely has to include a daily and domestic involvement in family life. Not before time, you might say, and in my view, you'd be right. But this vastly improved state of affairs has largely come about because of something else, which society is still not comfortable with in the least. This is working mothers. Whether they have to or they want to or both isn't really relevant. What is relevant is that women earning money, being seen to earn, and to acquire a consequent status because of it, has shifted the accepted balance between parents in terms of their responsibility towards their children, and therefore between the parents themselves. And we haven't even started on divorce and what this means for single parents of either gender. We are in a long period of transition about relations between the genders and therefore about the roles of fathers and mothers, which in my view won't be resolved in any of our lifetimes. Which makes, I have to say, the most brilliant material for fiction, even if it's far from brilliant for real life. I'm going to pause to read you a couple of passages here. They're about exactly this dilemma, the problem of women escaping the kitchen and wanting all the validity that their husbands assumed was their birthright in the past. I'm taking them from a novel I wrote 3 years ago called The Soldier's Wife, about a woman and her family trying to live with an army officer, husband and father, newly back from a tour of duty in Afghanistan. To research this novel, I virtually embedded myself with a regiment of gunners on Salisbury Plain. I even went on exercise with them. In this extract, Alexa is the wife, Dan is the soldier husband, and Isabel is their oldest child, aged 3. "Look," Alexa said, her eyes still on the tea, "look, I have to fight Isabel's corner. I have to fight my own corner. I want to be loyal. I've no trouble being loving. But I can't always put myself aside for some more demanding requirement. I can't abase myself, obliterate myself because of what Dan has to do and wants to do. Don't forget that. He loves the army, loves it. He's fulfilled by it. I love to see him fulfilled. I promise I do. But I can't live purely on his fulfillment. I'm a person too, with a brain as well as a heart and all the ambitions and hungers and curiosities that brains have. I also can't live on the emotional crumbs that fall from Dan's table after his men have finished eating the main meal. I know he loves me. He probably loves me more than he's ever loved any other person. But he's got me now, so he's free to love all this other stuff, this soldier stuff, and that has all the urgency and thrill of the chase that I can't possibly have now that I'm his wife and the mother of his children. He's back. But he's not back, not in any sense that's any use to me or his family. And if one more person tells me just to give him time, or that I knew what I was taking on, or that I'm so lucky to have the security, I would just kill them. But then, of course, there's Dan's side to the story. Dan's own needs, Dan's fulfillment, society's demand and respect for Dan to do what he so admirably does. Here is his grandfather, Eric, thinking about just that. Eric was a soldier too, and in the same regiment as his grandson. Eric dusted his hands off, one against another. If anyone had ever asked him, he'd have said that the best years of his life had been spent in Aden, never mind the heat and the dirt and the danger, and losing some of the best buddies he'd ever known. They were good years because he knew what he was doing and he knew what he was for. He'd had a purpose, and not only had he fulfilled it, he'd known it was of use to his fellow men, both those serving with him and those going about their business back in Blighty. That's what George had probably felt down there in the South Atlantic, although you'd think sometimes he'd never been there, the amount he'd ever talked about it. And it was what Dan was missing so violently now. You could recite every cliche about public good and common weal and productiveness until the bloody cows came home, but nothing took away from those clichés being true, from there being nothing that satisfied a man as much as the sense that he was of real value and visible use. Eric turned away and began to walk towards the nearest gate. Poor Dan, poor bloody Dan. Thankful to be back, and at the same time intensely homesick for Helmand. And that girl trying to deal with a man in that state, never mind mother her children, and keep up all the age-old appearances of the patch. Of course, the rules were a bit relaxed since his day. He remembered the strictures about no PDAs, public displays of affection, no girl soldiers to be seen drinking out of pint glasses. But he'd bet a pound to a penny that the snobberies of rank and demeanour were as rife as they'd ever been whatever lip service was paid to their passing. That poor bloody girl. If she wasn't getting through to Dan because he simply wasn't on message, who could she possibly turn to? So that dilemma, historic always, but urgent and noisy these days, of who does more in a family for the benefit of both children and the unit, is in fact more complex now that men are not just permitted, but encouraged to be involved fathers, especially those who do not have a fraction of David Beckham's money or celebrity. Being a wonderful father is one thing, but it seems to me, just as it was with most women once upon a time, a great many fathers want more than the domestic round, even if they initially think they aren't going to. Last year, I wrote a novel about a successful woman entrepreneur and businesswoman called Balancing Act, which is also about the effect female success has on the grown-up daughters she employs in the business and the husbands and sons-in-law who are inevitably affected. Here is one son-in-law's solution to his run-ragged wife's stress and exhaustion. Ashley is the middle daughter, married, her mother's marketing director and mother herself to two little children. Leo is her husband. They've just sacked a nanny who was called Cheryl and whom their three-year-old daughter only commended for her eyeliner. The Morris mentioned in the passage is Ashley's grandfather, long lost and useless, who's just turned up out of the blue and set every cat among the pigeons. I have a plan, Leo said. We can't have any plan right now, not with all the Morris stuff going on. That Morris stuff makes it perfect timing for a plan. That Barlaston house of your mother's and now Morris, it's ideal. It throws everything up in the air. You're brilliant at what you do in the company, but you need more clout. Maybe a pay rise. Maybe a payment structure like your parents have. I don't know. I don't care much, except I want to see you listen to more. And you won't be listened to more if you can't give more mental energy to work. And you can't give more mental energy to work if you're worrying about Cheryl feeding the kids badly and spending time in cafes with other nannies instead of teaching Maisie how to ride her bike. So, he paused and looked at her. He was smiling. So, she said. I'm going to do it, Leo said. She craned forward. What? For a year, anyway. We're sacking Cheryl, saving the money, and I'm going to look after the kids and run the house. Ashley swallowed. She said, but what about your teaching? He waved a hand. That can wait. But Leo, I want you to have this chance, Leo said. I want to be at home with the children. I want to do this family thing properly. I want to. Ashley nodded slightly. She said, are you sure? All that repetition, all morning making lunch for Fred that he won't then eat, other mothers at playgroup, other fathers with business trips to Singapore. All that, quite sure. Ashley got slowly to her feet. Gosh. And here is Leo, a few weeks later, having wimped out of going into a cafe where he'd been invited because all he could see in there were mothers and no fathers. His baby son is called Fred. Leo carried his meticulously made cappuccino to the sofa where they all sat to watch television. The cushions were still dented from the previous evening, and although Leo had determined not to be any more precious about the house than he was about food, the sight of the crushed and flattened cushions scattered with crumpled sheets of the Evening Standard brought home by Ashley the night before were disheartening. They looked as he felt, distinctly not proud of themselves. He sat down, his elbows on his knees, holding his mug of coffee. He looked at the foam on the top, the foam he had made. It lay in an even, light blanket, the edges just touched with coffee colour. He thought of how he'd felt at the weekend, how confident he'd been, especially with Grace, informing her in a forthright manner how she must conduct herself in future, stand up for her talents, stand up to her mother and her older sister, support Ashley in getting due recognition. He shut his eyes. What a load of cobblers, he told himself. What bullshit. Who did I think I was kidding? Do this, do that, Grace. And 3 days later, you're too chicken to walk into a cafe full of mothers, even though Fred gives you the perfect excuse. He bent his head, sucked at the foam blanket. He would, he thought, not tell Ashley about this morning. He would, in fact, tell nobody. His only witness, luckily, had been asleep, and in any case, couldn't talk. He'd be very cheery with Amanda when he saw her at the end of nursery school that day and pretend he'd had an appointment that prevented him from coming, and then he'd make a firm date to join them all next week, next Wednesday. Next Wednesday, he would obliterate the memory of today and tidy it away to the back of his mind as one of those beginner's mistakes that could happen to anyone. He looked around the room. Breakfast still lay sprawled messily across the table, and he knew a tangle of bed linen had been dumped on the floor in front of the washing machine but not yet put in. That meant that the beds upstairs were awaiting clean sheets, and while he was up there, he should really sort out the bathroom. He took another noisy gulp of coffee. Trouble was, he thought, he didn't feel like doing any of it. In fact, he felt an enormous resistance to doing any of the domestic chores that required doing before it was time to collect Maisie, a resistance that surprised him by its strength. He hadn't in his head made any allowance for the loneliness of his determinedly chosen new domestic role, or the repetitiveness or the banality. He'd longed to be welcomed in among those young women and had been ashamed of the longing, ashamed to demonstrate it. Had he wondered, elected to do something he was actually going to fail at, as he'd failed at so many things before? And then there was a wail from upstairs in the hallway. Fred was awake. Domestic life, said the wail, did not allow for options, and it was entirely oblivious to gender. Leo has before him the example of his father-in-law, Jasper, who is a failed rock musician, but instead proved to be adept at parenting. Here is his eldest daughter, Cara, talking about Jasper, her father, to her husband, Daniel. They're discussing a cottage that Cara and Ashley's mother want to buy for creative thinking, she says. And Daniel has been round to see his father-in-law to try to get him to persuade his wife out of the sale. Cara said, all our friends loved him, making music and making cakes. What more could you wish for? Daniel watched her. He said, but you don't want children. Nor do you. Agreed, but I just wondered. The kettle pinged itself boiled. Cara picked it up and came back to the breakfast bar. Dan, I'm not in a mood for an analysis of my childhood. Dad was great. Ma was fantastic. The company is pretty well all in all to you and me. Enough, don't you think? There was just something about your father this morning, something a bit, oh, I don't know, lonely or abandoned. And so what is Jasper thinking all those years after his hands-on fatherhood years? Well, he's thinking this. He isn't thinking what all men think, but there are some who think like this, just as women have done. Jasper is with his musician friend, Brady. They're sitting at Jasper's kitchen table, eating fish and chips out of the paper, and are most of the way down a bottle of red wine. Susie is Jasper's entrepreneur wife. Brady glanced at him. He said, you must be so proud of yours. I am. All chips off the Susie block. Success stories, everyone. Jasper gave a small sigh. Looked at like that, yes, everyone. Looked at like what? Career, Jasper said. Ambition. Getting somewhere in business. Yes, yes, all three of them. Brady waited a moment. He watched Jasper lick the batter crumbs off his finger. Then he said, you okay, Jas? Jasper thought a moment, then he pushed his reading glasses up on top of his head. He said, I don't know, really. Something happened. Jasper squinted at his wine. He said, well, yes. Susie's useless old dad turns up, doesn't he, out of the blue. But it's not that. Well, it's not that in itself. It's what you said. She's never here. There's no life here. There's me and the parrot. He turned and threw an affectionate glance over his shoulder towards the bird, who was apparently dozing on her perch. And we kind of wait, except we don't really know what we're waiting for. Her old dad, eh? He showed up in Stoke. Grace took him in. I've never met him. I don't want to meet him, to be honest. If I met him, I'd want to flatten him. And the girls all getting into a flap about him doesn't help. It doesn't help at all. It just makes me... He stopped. He said, do you know, Braid, it wasn't wonderful before, and now it's a whole lot worse. Brady leaned back. He said slowly, and there's me thinking the sun never went in for you. Don't get me wrong, Jasper said. I never wanted Suze to be different. I'd never have stopped her because I never wanted to stop her. She's amazing. She's a force of nature. I'm proud of her. I admire her. But it's me, Braid. I don't know where I fit in now with the girls in the business too. I thought of offering Grandad services to Ashley, but then I thought, you sad old git. What are you, begging for favours because you haven't pulled your bleeding finger out all these years? You haven't made the effort? You've just lain dozing under the mango tree, watching for lunch to fall off onto your stomach. Hey, Brady said, steady on. Sorry, Jasper said, sorry. He tapped his glass. It probably makes me maudlin. Brady looked round the kitchen. He said, you were a hell of a father. You brought up three kids here. Yep. Homework, the kids' friends, toast, spaghetti. And now it's you and the bird, mostly, and this old boy. He hasn't changed things, really. He's just woken me up to it all, I suppose. Brady leaned forward. He said, you're saying you're lonely, Jazz. Jasper took his reading glasses off his head and put them on the table. Then he rubbed his eyes. I'm not lonely, he said. I don't seem to do lonely, really. It's something else. It's more that I don't know what I'm for anymore. He looked across the table at Brady. He said, can you tell me, Braid, what the point of me is? As Joanna says, she just wanted to start the conversation. Thank you.